Hi, I'm Sharad Kutan. Welcome to Let's Talk, the show that brings you the most important conversations of the day. Today, we're going to be looking at, again, the question of Palestine, its larger geopolitical context, as well as some local realities. We're going to be speaking to an artist, a theatre practitioner in Ramallah later on in the show. But let me introduce my guests. I have Abdul Al-Fattah Al-Awaisi and also Ray Langbe, both professors in their respective fields. Abdul Fattah, you are in international relations, and Ray in performance. And the reason, Ray's here, people might actually want to understand, like, what is it that somebody in theatre is doing in a show about Palestine, is that you recently conceptualized and organized this symposium. It's called Recall, Reflect, Return, Palestinian Performance Art in Art Symposium, and it was held in Ramallah. And so we're going to be tapping you for some of your experiences, some of your thoughts about what you experienced there, especially with regard to the BDS movement. We'll come back to that. But let's roll some a shot that you took, Ray, at a protest.
And also, a Finnish filmmaker as well shot some of these.
Okay, so let's take a look at some of the footage that we have. Okay, Ray, tell us, what was that that we just saw?
That was the Nakba Day, the 15th of May this year. And that was a demonstration which went from the center of Ramallah to Kalandia checkpoint, which is the checkpoint between Ramallah and Jerusalem. It's the checkpoint that many Palestinians have to go through every day. I think that there's some other clips of cages, a series of cages that you have to go through in order to actually get to a final turnstile, which touches you in the front and the back at the same time. So your body is measured as you go through this this checkpoint, So it was going. The demonstration was going to the checkpoint. Never reached there because the Israeli army was in between.
One of the things we did see were people holding aloft something. Would look like
keys.
And why a key?
Keys, as I understand, the implication is the keys to the prisons in Israel, where many of the Palestinians, including Palestinian children, are incarcerated.
So, Abdul Al-Fattah, explain to us. I mean, you are actually a Palestinian born, now British national. The Nakba, what is the importance of the Nakba to the political imaginary of Palestinians?
The Nakba is in a very simple term. Palestinians remember when they have been kicked out, including my parents and my grandfathers and mother, kicked out from their homeland by force. And this is called this uprooting of you from your own homeland. My father is a farmer, my mom is a farmer, and they have been attached to the land. They have been uprooted and thrown out to live in a refugee camp as a result of the establishment of Israel as a Jewish state. This is what it's called, the Nakba.
And you are from Jerusalem, aren't you? How many people were uprooted from Jerusalem? Clearly, there are still people, both Muslim, Christians, and Jews who live in Jerusalem. Who were identified to be uprooted from Jerusalem at that point in time?
Jerusalem, during the British Mandate, from 1917 until 1947, it was called Mandate Jerusalem. So who uprooted in 1947? 80% of Jerusalem, which called West Jerusalem, because West Jerusalem is nearly 85% of the British Mandate, and 15% East Jerusalem, which has been occupied in 1967. So it is the majority of the people from Jerusalem. They have been uprooted and they have been kicked out from their homeland 85 of the Mandate Jerusalem. And here, just a comment, the key, why the Palestinians hold the key? This is the key of their doors, which they have been taken out. I still hold the key. I got it from my father, and I pass it to my children.
So key to homes.
The key of homes. We are passing it from generation to a generation to tell them one day we will return back to the land with the Israelis, with the international community, in particular at that time the British, and later on by the Americans, kicked out from our homeland.
Right. Ray, when you conceptualize this symposium, you're a professor of live art and performance studies at the University of the Arts, Helsinki. What is it for you? Why was the Palestinian story, why was, citing the symposium in Ramallah or in the occupied territories important for you, that you pushed for this and got the funding for it and organized it?
Well, as a citizen of the United States, I felt that my country was very involved in this. And without the support of the United States, so I saw it as a national responsibility, in a sense. Without the support of the United States, I believe that the occupation would not be sustainable. So that was one element. It's also one of the longest standing human rights issues in the world. It's the longest standing occupation, as I understand, in the world. And there were a number of Finnish organizations I noticed that were engaged in it, building schools and also there's some theater groups in Finland who were doing transfer of students into the West Bank. So I began to notice this as well, and the university was quite receptive to this kind of work, which would not always be the case. And I was able to use the funding for my department in funding this particular event.
Right. I mean, geography is so central to understanding the events that we see unfold in Israel today and in the occupied territories. Could you explain to us the difference between Ramallah, where this festival happened, and, say, Gaza? It was a subject of a discussion from an earlier show. The experience of occupation, does it differ from place to place, from Jerusalem to the West Bank to Gaza, for Arab Israeli citizens, for instance, as well?
Basically, if you look at the map, this is needs geographical explanation. If you look at the map, this is called Palestine, and which is 20,000 kilometers square from the north, Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, the Mediterranean, and then Egypt. This was when the British came and occupied, and then the British mandate. Then it was more or less about 75% occupied in 1947. And then West Bank and Gaza occupied in 1967. Gaza was a strip, very tiny strip, 45 kilometers, with 5 kilometers to 7 kilometers, big prison, without even having a blockade in Gaza. It is not connected with the West Bank. You need to go through the land occupied in 1948, to cross from Gaza to Al-Khalil and then to Jerusalem. After Oslo Accord and the establishment of the Palestinian National Authority, this has been divided more and more. For example, if someone from Al-Khalil, Hebron, would like to go to Ramallah, he need to go through Jerusalem. He need a special permission from the Israelis to go to go to Ramallah. And this is divide the families. Added to it, the Israelis established what I call the apartheid wall, which separate families. You are same family, you are in one room, I'm in the other room here. This is how the division happening in the West Bank. Gaza Strip is already isolated, and the West Bank in itself to move from one city to another, yani from Ramallah. This we have seen. This is I went through this, and this is the worst humiliation you can expect in that. So to cross from, you need to be checked, and you need to be humiliated. Sometimes taking out of your clothes, only the underwear, to be there to check that you are not a terrorist.
Okay, Ray, your experience of Israel and the checkpoints and so on. What did it make you feel? I mean, how did you respond to it?
Well, I'm very interested in the history of biometrics and British biometrics and American biometrics, the measuring of the body in different ways, whether it's mentally IQ issues or the measuring of the body with the Lamprey method or the Huxley method during the British colonial period. Where people were placed in front of a grid and their bodies were measured, colonial bodies were measured regularly. And the Americans continued this policy in the Philippines and other colonial areas. So biometrics, I'm very interested in how that takes place, but what the humiliation is very, very clear. If a person is slightly overweight, the turnstile does not change its calibration. It presses against the body, and you know that you are caught. The turnstile often stops halfway through, so you are caught then in the turnstile.
So very visceral experience.
Very visceral.
Okay, we'll have to come back to that. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back with a conversation with somebody from Ramallah right now. Stay tuned. Hi, and welcome back to Let's Talk. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Ray Langenbach and Abu al-Fattah al-Awaisi, both of them engaging with me on a conversation about the Palestinian question. Now, we have on the line Muhammad Rabba Ali Ahmed. He is the executive director of the Palestinian Circus School. Thank you so much, Muhammad, for joining us. You are in Ramallah, am I correct?
Thank you for hosting me. Yes, I'm in Ramallah.
Okay.
I'm calling you from the Circus School.
If we could begin with just telling us, what is the situation in Ramallah today and the last couple of weeks? We understand there's been some trouble in Ramallah. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, I think the situation escalated because the Israeli politicians decided to use the Palestinian to create a military action for political reasons. I think Netanyahu government is suffering, and they need to use the threat of Palestinian for political gain. So what happened is there was invasion from the Israeli military to Ramallah, kidnapping and assassination of citizens with cold blood in the streets, in the checkpoints, and also destroying demolition houses of Palestinians. It happened in the villages around Ramallah. In Ramallah, the PA, in political coordination with the PA forces also leads the entire city, the citizens, the Palestinian citizens, and the unarmed citizens alone without any coverage or support.
Can I ask you, is this an unusual situation? We were covering Gaza in our last discussion. Does the experience of occupation in Gaza differ significantly from the situation in Ramallah?
It's a completely different situation. In Gaza, it's a siege. There's no existence of settlers and Israeli military actions on the ground in Gaza, but there is the airstrikes and the siege in Gaza. While in the West Bank, we interact with the settlers on the roads. Settlers can go on the roads with their guns and shoot the Palestinians because there's a lot of roads that come on between us and them. The checkpoint is there in every city. So the interaction with the military happened in a daily matter in West Bank. The siege is less. The the Palestinian Authority is more active than the West Bank, and the security coordination between the PA, the Palestinian Authority, and the Israeli is on a higher level than the West Bank. While in Jerusalem, it's another place for Jerusalem, Palestinians living in Jerusalem, where they suffer on a daily basis from discrimination and apartheid regime.
Okay, so you've painted a very stark picture of the different experiences that people have. You work in the Palestinian Circus School. I think you've just become the executive director there. You're also well known for your work in role-playing and using the arts. Why and what is the place of the arts and theater in dealing with or giving back the tools to especially a traumatized population?
Well, there's many organizations and also many funding coming to Palestine from many countries, including the European Union, the USAID, for many civil society organizations that try to somehow, the main aim of this funding is to keep the status quo. But there's a lot of natural grassroots organizations that, like the Circus School or the Role Playing Organization and many other voluntary organization in the art sector, for example, the popular art groups, folkloric groups, have been here since more than 40 years, and they have been one of the symbols of the Palestinian resistance and connecting the Palestinian people all over the world. But the circus and the role playing are new art tools that have been introduced to the Palestinian society in an organizational aspect. The circus was established in 2006. I joined recently to be the executive director. Basically, we work with children, around 250 children, and with a vision that circus will give the children a new perspective of life, more hope, new tools to express themselves and send their messages, and also to develop and be aware. So work with art as a tool for liberating the mind, emancipating the mind and the body.
Hello.
Yes.
One of the live action role plays that you did, which was became extremely famous, was the one in Scandinavia, and you also did another one with my students, and I'm wondering if you could maybe talk a bit about how you use simulation of roles which exist in the political situation in Palestine, including Fatah and Hamas. You had people take the roles of interrogator, interrogatee, of spy, of these different roles which appear in a colonial situation like this and an occupation. And I wonder if you could talk a bit about that. Because people here might not know what live action role play, how it can be used or what it is.
So in 2011, I was introduced to role-playing games. And basically, role-playing games, we used very similar theater techniques, but there is no audience. And we invite people to live a story in a fictional world where they have equal characters. There is no main character. Everyone has an equal character. And since then, we try to develop our own stories to express and tackle different issues and also to give experiences to people that they never had. And like we use it for example, to do mock demonstrations and to give the people a feeling how it is to be in the resistance and how it is to oppose the oppression. And then the next level with for example, for us in India, we started to think, okay, maybe it's to simulate the life under occupation. For Scandinavian people, because whatever we tell them, it's different than they feel it, and they immerse the feeling of the oppression. So we designed a role-playing game that lasted for 3 days, and we did it twice in 2013 and 2016. And in that game, we created a fictional world for 70 people. In that fictional world, Finland is occupied. We invented the occupier. We invented a new history for Finland with political parties similar somehow to Palestinian political parties, but with Finnish context. We invented the occupier with similar apartheid and oppression regime as the Israeli occupation forces, but we did something else, or aliens, for example. And that was, we lived that the players played students at Helsinki University. They are active against occupation. Some of them are calling for peaceful resistance. Some of them are calling for armed resistance. So we brought that dialogue to Finnish people. And some of the characters were army. So there was interrogation, arresting. Some characters played professors of the university. Some characters played human rights activists, journalists. For 3 days, all this interaction with different blocks, with invasion and interrogation and political dialogue, those players pretend that this is happening in Finland.
I remember.
Thank you. Sorry, we've run out of time, Muhammad. Thank you so much for joining us. Look forward to another conversation at another point in time. I've been speaking to Muhammad Rabah Ali Ahmad. He's the executive director of the Palestinian Circus School, explaining to us some of the techniques they use to deal with children who are living under the occupation. Stay tuned to this discussion. Welcome back to Let's Talk. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Professor Al-Fatah Al-Awaisi. He's a professor of international relations at University Utara Malaysia. It's a visiting position. He's actually based in the Social University of Ankara. Is that correct? And also Ray Langenbeck, who was professor of live art and performance studies at the University of the Arts Helsinki during the time in which you organized this fascinating symposium that brought together, I believe, 16 Palestinian artists, theorists, historians, and people from 13 countries. And of course, it raises questions about engagement. And I want to ask you this, Abdul Fatah, the question of engagement. All these people, international people, coming to the occupied territories, engaging, does that break the BDS principles, the principles of, you know, of boycott or divestment and sanctions? What's your position on this?
I think the problem which international community need to realize, we have been under occupation. And the word occupation, unfortunately, is not remembered in the mind and in the body of the people outside, where the Palestinian, they have been suffering from occupation. Unfortunately, since the establishment of Israel and also the occupation of West Bank and Gaza, and Oslo, with the Oslo Accord and with the establishment of the Palestinian National Authority, the occupation turned to be a seven-star occupation. And what the international community is doing is encouraging that seven-star occupation. For example, the former Prime Minister of Britain, Tony Blair, when he engage in what we call economical peace, to bring peace through economy. This is another way of establishing the occupation and let young generation graduated and then being tied to the occupation by way or another and not thinking of getting rid of this occupation.
Okay, I want to ask you this, because in fact, Muhammad Rabah, earlier when we talked to him, and he's with the Palestinian Circus School, he said very interestingly, talking about EU funding for some of the civil society projects, he said the funding is for the status quo, for keeping the status quo. That's one way of looking at it. The other way to look at it is it's a humanitarian gesture, because if there is a population that is under occupation, they still need schools, they still need education, they need their minds educated and stimulated and so on and so forth. So where's the balance?
They provide international community, some organization in America and in Europe, they provide the Israelis in 1 second, they destroy it. The example happened in the West Bank, happened in Gaza, that not only from, even from some Arab countries, some Arab rich countries, they will provide for support, then Israelis will destroy it in 1 second. The problem, as we in international relation, that you have two ways. One is to manage the conflict, and second, to resolve the conflict. What is happening since the establishment of Israel is managing the conflict, and the international community is not willing to resolve the problem.
Okay, that's pitched at a very interesting level. It's an international relations story. But what for you, Ray, as somebody trying to organize a festival, trying to negotiate the BDS movement, which, tell us about that. How did you, what were the encounters you had? What were the kind of conversations you had in order to pull this off, this symposium?
Well, it was essential for me to have partners on the ground first. Because otherwise I would not know how to engage with the local populace, and so those collaborations with Palestinian the head of the symphony, who's now based in Bethlehem, with the Nawat Theater, a family theater in Arab camp, and with people at the Khalil Sakakini Center in Ramallah, and people at Birzeit University near Ramallah. Those were essential connections, and one thing that they made very clear was that it was not possible for anyone coming to this symposium to stop in Israel to do performances or engagements with institutions in Israel, and that was for them the dividing line.
So they didn't want the engagements to be on the Israeli side.
That's right, because a number of the performance artists had actually the two who were most obvious did not come, but had been to festivals in Israel, and one view in Palestine was, well, if they had ever been performing in Israel, that they should not come. That was the strong stance. Other people felt that, well, maybe that is not necessarily where the line should be. And my view as an educator is that education is I would not be an educator if I did not believe that people actually can learn and improve through the process of education. So I was arguing that these people should come, but they should no longer engage with those groups that they had engaged with previously in Israel.
What do you make of this debate about who you engage with? Do you expect somebody to have from when they were little, as it were, taking a strong position? Or do you accept that people evolve and they are political, and there's an opportunity here to work with whatever their history might have been, their prehistory might have been, to engage with them?
I will not be an idealist. I will be myself here. I look at Israel, stolen my land, stolen my life, uprooted me and my family, which has been there for thousands of years, and then throw me out, then I look at them like a thief. So I'm not willing to share a platform with any Zionist or with any Israelis who is part of this political engagement, political establishment in Israel. How I can sit with someone, okay, Palestinian politician, they have tried for 25 years or more to negotiate with the Israelis to reach a settlement of a two-state solution. And after 25 years, what is the result? Big zero.
Okay, so what would you, if I brought onto the stage Palestinian, Arab, Muslim members of the Knesset, would you talk to them?
No problem.
That's no problem.
No problem.
But they engage with the state. They legitimize the state by being members of the Knesset.
But they are opposing. And for example, just this week, there was a debate on the Knesset regarding any Palestinian's family, their son or their daughter, involved in any attack against Israel. They will kick them out. These Palestinians, Arab, in the Knesset, they voice their voice, and then they have been kicked out from the
Knesset.
Yeah, so they are not Zionists. They are not Israeli. Yeah, Israeli by citizenship, by default, if I may put it in this way, because they haven't been kicked out from their homeland in 1948.
What about the peace movement in Israel? There is a peace movement, and there are people who don't want to see the end of the Israeli state, but they want to see peace.
That was, at some point, they have a voice, but now disappear. We don't hear their voices. It seems they have finished their mandate. We are moving now in a stage after, yani Palestinians, they tried, what I'm saying, they tried the process of peace, not the peace. And this did not prove. This is why the Palestinians are frustrated with their politician. They are frustrated with their politician. They are frustrated by the Arabs, who are now trying to normalize relation. Saudi Arabia, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, is trying to normalize, and maybe the Israeli flag will be in Riyadh, and the Saudi flag might be in Jerusalem.
Virtually everybody that I encountered there was for a one-state solution, which would be called Palestine. And that was the only
in which was acceptable. Jews and Arabs.
It would be
and
a multicultural state,
okay.
And it would be a democracy. Is the ideal form, and that as two-state solution at this point in time, most people feel is impossible because of the settler colonialism,
yes.
Which has divided up all of the lands of the West Bank. And then you have little Gaza over here, so you have complete dismemberment of what used to be the possibility of a Palestinian state. So I think that is no longer really held as seriously by most of the people that I encountered. They see this as a long-term play.
And it will
be generations. I think that some of them believe that this will take generations of time in order to have that Palestinian state.
See allies on the Israeli side? I mean, do they see that discussion of a one-state, multicultural, democratic Palestine coming from the other side, as it were, are they engaging with that? I mean, in your experience?
In the short time that I've been there, in the last year and a half, 2 years, I have not seen any engagements between the two, although I know that there are Israelis. I've met Israelis who are very strongly against the occupation. But the issue of the one of a single Palestinian state, yes, some of them hold that, but I haven't seen this dialogue taking place because that has been seen as normalization, and so normalization meant that the agents for change in Israel no longer really meet the agents for change in
We'll hold the thought. We're going to come back. We'll take a short break. Stay tuned to Let's Talk. Hi, welcome back to Let's Talk with me, Sharad Kutin. With me, I have Professor Abdul Al-Fattah Al-Awaisi and also Professor Ray Langenbach. Both of them engaged with me in a conversation about Palestine and the shifting nature of the conversation in Palestine. Ray, you had mentioned the one-state solution that has now appeared, partly because in some ways the two-state solution has now become untenable. And Al-Fattah, you could explain to us, in your mind, when did the two-state solution die as a possibility?
Well, the two-state solution was favored by the international community, and they were pushing, in particular, the Palestinians to accept the two-state solution, and the Palestinian and the National Authority and the PLO accept the two-state solution, and they start working in the two-state solution. However, since they accepted the Israeli in the ground with more settlement in Jerusalem and in the West Bank, the idea of a two-state solution disappeared until recently, until the Knesset passed a new basic law, national basic law, which basically saying this is a Jewish state. There will be no two-state solution, and the only one who will be favored is a Jew. This is, according to the Western and the American standard, this is discrimination. Imagine any Muslim country establish an Islamic state and call it an Islamic state, what will happen? The whole globe will be standing against this Islamic state. But when the Knesset approved the establishment of a Jewish state, everyone is silent.
Well, I wonder though, there were protests on the streets of Tel Aviv and in Israel against, these were Israelis protesting.
The protest came mainly, and there was a letter sent from a certain group within the Israeli community, a tiny minority called the Druze, because they served in the Israeli army. According to this law, after they serve and die for the security of Israel, this law goes against them. So they were the first group of people protesting against it, and they requested this to be revised. But unfortunately.
Okay, well, I want to ask you though, it seems to be, we go back to the history of Zionism, mm-hmm. the idea of a homeland for Jews, right? But at the same time, you know, the founding fathers of the state, the modern state of Israel, also had other ideologies. They were socialists, they were this mm-hmm. and that, you know, the Herzogs and the Weizmanns. So the question really is at the heart of Israel a kind of schizophrenia? I mean, aren't they unsure about who they want to be? And is it because of Bibi Netanyahu and his politics that they have been pushing in this rather, you know, chauvinistic direction?
I think since, I mean, before the Nakba, it's been very clear that ethnic cleansing was mm-hmm. part of the program all along. And you can find many quotes along the way from Ben-Gurion mm-hmm. and back to Herzl.
Mm-hmm. And the transfer, and the concept of also transfer.
Yeah.
Transfer Palestinians, send them to Jordan, yes, and yes. establish a Palestinian state.
Yes,
sorry,
So I think that the plan, and you can find Israeli historians like Ilan mm-hmm. Pape and mm-hmm. others who have very clearly shown through documents of the Israeli army itself, through the Haganah and other arms and the government, that was always the plan. It was to cleanse mm-hmm. and to have a terra nullia, terra nullis, you know, where an empty state which could then be populated by wave on wave of Europeans. Mm-hmm. So it's really what we're talking about is the last wave of European colonialism.
And also to support this, even when Britain helped the establishment of the state of Israel, what was the propaganda? That we are giving Palestine the land without people to the people without a land. So they will propagate that there was no Palestinians living there.
Yeah.
There is no, so the ideology is we are coming, establish a state, kick the Palestinian out, mm-hmm. transfer them, send them to Jordan or Transjordan, establish there through ethnic cleansing. This is what Israelis
are
doing.
So we have, though, now since the end of World War II, an international body, the United Nations. It has many conventions, including the International Convention Against the Elimination of, you know, for the elimination of all forms of racial discrimination. I said that was a part of a recent protest here, that can be used by the Palestinian population against the state of Israel. Isn't there still hope that? That Israel and the tendencies in Israel to kind of ethnic cleansing can be stopped, what do you think?
Unfortunately, that's the simple answer. Because the Palestinians are weak, they are not supported by the international community. They try to voice their voice, but no one is listening to them for several reasons. And this is very, very, very crucial that when it comes to the security of Israel, no one, the Americans, the European, even the Arabs now, they are not willing to negotiate. They are saying Israel has been established to exist. It doesn't matter what is the prices of the Palestinian. I think the problem is with the international community, with the that they are not putting enough pressure. For example, the American administration, look at the Trump administration. What they are doing, they are now not the mediator between the two parties. They are now on the side of Israel.
Well, they stop being honest brokers in the conversation. I do want to ask Ray.
They never actually were.
Yeah. Okay, but in the attempts, they did at some point attempt to, at least when we look at the status of Jerusalem, for instance. But I do want to ask you, what is the self-perception? When you talk to the Palestinians that you engage with, do they feel isolated? Do they feel that the world community has, in fact, abandoned them?
I would say yes. The people that I engage with, they're different classes in Palestine. And for example, the people who are in Al Arab camp, who are refugees in a refugee camp and primarily working class, they do not have a hope of leaving Palestine and going internationally and engaging outside. So they have a very different view, I think, of the situation than people in Ramallah, for example, who are very erudite, part of an international art scene, culture scene. People like Mohammed, who goes to Scandinavia. So there are different kinds, there are different classes, and I think that also has to be recognized, because there is I noticed a kind of a breakdown in communication sometimes between the working class people in Arab camp, who feel more oppressed than people in other places. So I think that it's a complex societal issue as well as an international issue. And I mean, the one place where I would say I disagree with you a bit is when you go to Palestine, there's the Palestinian Museum. There are many groups which are engaged with outside groups. There is a strong and vibrant culture, and I think, in the long game of a single state solution, it would be utterly devastating for people not to have any cultural engagements with the outside world.
Right.
I think that would work against the well-being of the people, in the kind of prison in the mind, the occupation of the mind would take over in a way.
Let's hold that thought and I'll come back to it, because I don't know if that's what Abdel Fattah was actually arguing for, but let's stay with this conversation. Stay with us, we'll be back. Welcome back to Let's Talk. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Ray Langenbach and Abdel Fattah Al-Awaisi. Abdel Fattah, I want to ask you about this, something that you're credited for, which is the generating a notion, an expression, Islamic Jerusalem. And I wonder if that notion can help us in this conversation that we're having about Palestine and the future. What is Islamic Jerusalem? Could you explain that?
In a very simple term.
And it's one word.
It is one word, not two separate words. In a very simple term, the terminology created at the beginning of the Islamic era on this holy land was Baytul Maqdis. If we translate this in English, it doesn't mean anything. So we came with what is the people know, Jerusalem and Islamic. So we combined them to invent a new terminology. And Islamic Jerusalem means this land can be for everyone, which is, I develop a model, for example, a model of Aman. What is Aman? Aman is peaceful coexistence and mutual respect. Not only peaceful coexistence, but there should be mutual respect. And we developed this field, and as I learned from professors, my colleagues in linguistic, that if it is one word, it's more stronger than two separate words, like non-violence as one word and non-violence as two words.
Or hyphenated.
So, yeah. So this is presenting, shocking people, because in Europe, in America, when they are talking, this is a Jewish land. This is the promised land, etc., etc. So you shock people intellectually. Our job is an argument and counter argument. So shocking people. Islamic Jerusalem. What is Islamic Jerusalem? Come on. Can we engage with you? So it's an invitation to engage with other scholars in America and in Europe. And we were successful in, we established this field about 25 years. And the degree were issued from Aberdeen University, and before that from Aberdeen Dundee in Scotland, and now in Malaysia, the first institute of center of excellence for Islamic Jerusalem studies it at University Yotra Malaysia, and also recently we established it in Ankara. So this is an intellectual academic exercise to face the intellectual Nakba, which is the crisis, intellectual crisis. We have the Nakba of uprooting people military and politically, but before the occupation of this holy land, there was the occupation of the mind.
What is interesting about your explanation about Islamic Jerusalem is that you suggested it suggests a future that is multicultural and peaceful coexistence part of it. I do want to come back to the BDS movement, because one of the claims it makes is, and what has been very successful in doing, is shifting the discourse and introducing the expression apartheid into the discourse. Mm-hmm. And this is really hurts the Israeli state. They don't like the idea of being called an apartheid state. Mm-hmm. But on the ground, Ray, is the feeling that of real separation between Palestinians and Israelis, between Muslims, Christian, Arabs, and their Jewish core, I'm not co-religionists, but they share the same space, they share the same land. Because the future of this that you're suggesting demands that they somehow see a common humanity, doesn't it?
Can I come
for
a moment, if you don't mind? My colleagues, Karen Armstrong, a prominent English historian, she said, this land is the land of conflict until the second Muslim Khalif, Umar ibn al-Khattab, entered into Baytul Maqdis, and he managed to establish a system for the first time in history where Christian, Jews, and Muslim managed to live together. That is the model it provided when Islam came to this region. Unfortunately, the Byzantines exclude the Jews for 500 years of living in the holiness of Baytul Maqdis. The Crusaders, when they came for Europe for 88 years, they exclude the Jews and exclude the Muslims. The Israelis now, they control Al-Masjid Al-Aqsa and they prevent Christians from going to their holy churches, either in Bethlehem or in Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. Throughout, I'm quoting here my colleague Karen Armstrong, at the only time it was under the Muslim rule where Muslims, Christians, and Jews managed to live in peace and harmony and mutual respect.
Interesting, Karen Armstrong. I believe some of her books are still banned in Malaysia. We hope this new government unbans Karen Armstrong's books. Ray, that feeling again, since you were on the ground recently.
I have met Jews in Palestine, who live in Palestine, who work for the One State Solution in Palestine. It's a very multicultural society in Palestine.
And I'm talking in the occupied territories.
Yes, I think that that's possibly a little piece of that model. I mean, we're talking about a very major a shift in a societal of construction. But at the same time, you know, the separation is extreme. When you encounter the walls, you know, which go right through the middle of the cities, it's very clear about what the separation that the Israeli state wants. There are signs warning Israelis not to go into the Palestinian areas because their lives are at stake. Their lives really aren't at stake. It's been pointed out to me by Jews who live there that their lives are not at stake, and that these signs are simply a way of frightening the, right. the
Israeli population. Because the creation of separation. So the wall is really a monument to separation
apartheid. Yeah, who's in the prison and who's outside the prison? Because Israel itself has become ghettoized.
On this multicultural side, there's no problem between Muslims and the Christian in the Holy Land. I will give you an example. One of my colleagues, I did not realize he's a Christian. His name is Muhammad. And I only discover after so many years, and then I realize I can't remember what was there. And he said, a Christian. I said, your name is Muhammad. I said, you see, this is the society. This is the framework. He's a Christian, but his name is
Muhammad.
I think that might send a message, a positive message.
This is very similar to Indonesia. Yeah. Yes.
Well, anyway, unfortunately, we run out of time. Thank you so much, Edmund, for being in the show and helping us understand this really difficult conversation that's coming from the Middle East. Perhaps a lesson for the rest of us in the world. We're coming into Christmas season very soon. And remember, the birthplace of Jesus Christ is, in fact, Bethlehem in the West Bank. Which is under occupation. So you've been with me. I'm Sharad Kutun, and this is Let's Talk, only on Astro Wani.